Twofootedtackle.com.
Hello and welcome to the Two-Footed Tackle podcast, which is going globe-trotting again this week. From Iberia to South America via Lowestoft, no place is too big for our wandering eye. Plus, there's the usual on MLS and the Premier League, and we'll try and be kind enough to Liverpool fans not to mention the word Northampton. All that and more on the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. So, yes, hello and welcome to the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. I'm Gary Andrews, your humble host for the next hour or so. And as this pod has a distinctly Latin flavour to it, I thought I'd introduce our guests in the style of a well-known dance show. So, first up, watching Aston Villa on a regular basis, this man knows when he's been tangoed, Chris Nee. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Thanks very much for that.
That's okay. I was trying to put in a Phil Brown reference there, but I realise you're nearly as pale as I am.
Yeah, we've already got a new manager, thank you, so we don't need any Phil Brown comments.
Phil Brown needs a regular appearance in the pod. People might forget about him otherwise.
Not when he's on Fighting Talk at the weekend, embarrassing himself in front of a crowd in Gateshead.
I never listened to that, and I'm now going to make a note of that.
You know that feeling you get when you've got a bloke in front of a crowd who you know are just whipping him to death, and he's pretending to enjoy it? Very odd.
Wonderful. Sam bring into the pod with all the silky sills you'd expect. South American football expert Tim Vickery. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I've been abroad now for 16 years, and one of the drawbacks or perhaps advantages of this is I haven't got a clue who downtown Phil Brown is.
Oh!
I don't know the guy. I don't know the guy.
Definitely an advantage.
He has the skin colour of a man who spends a lot of time in South America.
True. If he's probably never been there.
Probably.
Well,
he won't have been scouting there. And he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would go that far for a holiday.
Torremolinos,
I think, is more his style.
He said that he'd been on a motorcycling holiday last summer.
Well, Che Guevara did that.
Yeah, exactly. So he might have been Cuba. I think he said, I'm spending it on the chairman's yacht. Phil Brown, Google him, Tim. He's an impressive character. Don't look for images, though. It's actually quite disturbing. His most recent appearance is a man in midlife crisis. Finally, cha-cha-charing interview, although that might just be a scouting report on the latest 17-year-old Latvian wunderkid, James Appel.
Thanks for inviting me on with such esteemed company, Gary.
That's great to have you on again, James.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Fantastic. Right, down to business. As we're lucky enough to have Tim in the studio at the moment, let's start off in South America with Brazil. First off, their national team. Tim, ex-Corinthians Mano Menezes. I probably pronounced that wrong.
That's good enough. That'll do.
That'll do. He wasn't the first choice to replace Dunga, but how do you think he'll get on in the job?
Well, I think it's a very, very interesting moment. And I think it's so often in football, defeat is an opportunity to have a rethink and maybe to come back stronger, because Mano Menezes, it looks as if from the early days there's going to be something very different from the direction that Brazilian football has taken over the past, say, 15, 20 years, where they've played with a very narrow midfield, and they've used the fullbacks as they've given the flanks as corridors for the fullbacks to push up, and as the fullbacks attack, the defensive midfielders become more defensive. So you get that's really the reason that you have Gilberto Silva plodding around in a Brazilian midfield for over 90 times. That's gone now a little bit. Mano Menezes has come in. He's in tune with what's happening globally. He likes 4-2-3-1. He wants conventional fullbacks who will push forward, yes, but as elements of surprise, not all the time. So it's going to be a more fluid game with all-round midfielders. They've only played once under him so far, which was a game against the United States in August. And August friendlies, I think international friendlies anyway, I think it's unwise to draw too many conclusions, and that's especially true of August friendlies. But they were very, very impressive in beating the United States in the United States 2-0, and could have beaten them by a much, much greater margin. They weren't able to get opponents for September. As it stands, they haven't got opponents for October either, which is unfortunate. But the early signs are that this is something promising. It's a difficult task, really, for 2014, because between now and then, Brazil have very, very few competitive games. They have the Copa America next year. They have the Confederations Cup, which is semi-competitive anyway, in 2013. And that's it to prepare for the 2014 World Cup. So the accent is very much going to be on youth as well. Next January, we've got the South American Under-20 Championships, which, as well as qualifying four sides for the World Youth Cup next year, will also qualify two for the London Olympics. And that's very serious for Brazil. And it's serious for them anyway, because it's the only title that they can win that they haven't won. So they'd love to do that to kind of complete their set. But also, it's an important halfway house for them in terms of the 2014 World Cup. So that'll be very interesting in January to see if Brazil can get one of those top two places in Peru in the South American Under-20 Championships and qualify for the London Olympics. Because if they do, that'll be an important moment when the work of Manuel Menezes will be judged.
Chris, where do you think Brazil's standing is on the world stage at the moment? Because everybody sees them as kind of this wonderful, entertaining team. They haven't quite been that. And then we saw them at the World Cup. They were definitely not the best team by any stretch at the World Cup
They weren't. They did have the machine look about them for a little while. And obviously the game against the Netherlands put pay to that idea. But it'd be interesting to know actually how Dunga's legacy is going to affect Menezes. Because is it going to help him, or is it going to bring down expectations too much?
There isn't much of a legacy in terms of players, because that was one of the oldest squads that Brazil have ever taken to a World Cup, and the youngest member of that squad was Ramirez, who's already almost mid-20s. So really, it's a slate wiped clean. And perhaps after the Dunga thing, and Brazil have taken this route for a while now, where they look to play mainly on the counter-attack, and there's been a philosophy in Brazilian football that if the move has more than 7 passes, then the chances of a goal are reduced. And Dunga really took that to its extremes. And the Dunga Brazil were very effective up to that World Cup quarter-final against Holland, and they were very effective in that one in the first half. But it was very much a counter-attack and set-pieces team. And Brazilian eyes were really opened by this game that I referred to, the 2-0 win over the United States, because it was a team that exchanged something like 600 passes during the game. And Brazilians haven't seen that from their national side for a long, long time. It's almost like the ghost of a steam train's kind of running round their track. And I, as an optimist and as a lover of the traditional virtues that made Brazilian football so popular all around the world, I'm optimistic that we're going to get something different and something a little bit easier on the eye, because I think we need it. And I think football is never just about what you do. It's always about how you do it. And many in Brazil have lost sight of that, I think, over recent years. The concentration has been so much on the victory that they've forgotten just why they're so loved. And the 1982 side, which there are clear flaws in the 82 side, but it's remembered now, nearly 30 years later. Lots of people of our generation still remember that side for the impression that it caused. I would like to see Brazil get more in touch with the kind of football they were playing then. Yes, the game has changed. It's quicker, it's more physical, but we're seeing, just say I'm here in the Premiership, I've seen Arsenal a couple of times over the last few days. We're seeing that passing football, Barcelona, it's another example, that passing football can prevail at the highest level. There isn't necessarily a need for everyone to bulk up, because that's something that Brazil have done very much so, especially since 1974, when they couldn't really cope with the pressure on the ball that Holland put them under. And Brazil, the side that went to the World Cup, is a huge, it's like a basketball side. You know, football is still played on the ground, a low centre of gravity, the ability to change directions, the ability to change passes quickly. These are the kind of things that we want to see from the Brazilian national team. And I'm optimistic that under Manuel Menezes, there'll be moves in that direction.
It doesn't seem to be much room for supper for a lot of the old guard, though, in there. Ronaldinho, obviously, probably the biggest name, who still doesn't seem to get in the squad. And, you know, he's better than he was a few years ago now, or more applied than he was.
He'll have his chance. Manuel Menezes, and the squads that he's called up so far, either for the game against the States or for training sessions, has been very much looking at new players. But he has explicitly said that the door is not closed on the old generation. Now the ball is in their court to do enough to force a recall. And Ronaldinho has said that he wants to play the 2014 World Cup. I'm inclined to doubt it. He'll be 34, and those are 34 years, will be in 2014, that have packed a lot of life in them on and off the field. So I'm inclined to doubt it. But the man is a football genius. And I saw this with Romário, for example, when he went back to Brazil. There were times when he just looked like an ex-player, someone who'd retired years ago, shuffling around. But when he wanted to, he'd turn the tap on, and he could be astonishing. Genius lives by different rules, so the chance is there. Can Ronaldinho keep up the motivation for long enough? Can he stay disciplined for long enough to force a recall? Only time will tell.
He's at a good club, though, James, for older players at Milan with their famous Milan lab. And he's also got a couple of other Brazilians for company with Robinho and Pato there as well.
Yeah, that's right. Tim's kind of alluded to something that I'd be interested to pick up on is Dunga obviously was kind of the arch-disciplinarian, if you like, taking all the kind of, let's say, flawed genius aspects of Brazil and trying to hammer out the kind of partying and womanizing, let's say, of some of the players. I'm interested to know whether you think, you mentioned Ronaldinho and Robinho, whether you think Mano Menezes is going to give them a slightly freer rein socially as well as kind of, you know, on the field, as you've already hinted at.
Oh, perhaps. And in Dunga's defence, he was perhaps Robinho's biggest defender. I think Robinho probably played more under Dunga than any other player. So there was always space in his team for Robinho. I think one thing that perhaps Dunga did, after seeing the evidence of the 2006 World Cup, where Carlos Alberto Parreira was coach, the growth of the media, especially the growth of cable TV, because cable TV had become almost like radio, 24 hours on the air, wanting access to the players all the time. And Brazil in 2006 didn't really deal with that. They hadn't really adapted to the new media reality. They gave the media too much access. Dunga went too far, perhaps, the other way. And the problem there is that you create enemies in the media, and then there's people gunning for you. There was a moment after the Ivory Coast game, when Brazil beat the Ivory Coast. It was the second group game in the World Cup. In the press conference afterwards, Dunga looked, it was almost like having a nervous breakdown. He kept on muttering and swearing away at an entirely inoffensive Brazilian journalist. And he would answer other questions, and then he'd mutter and swear away. And then while other questions were being asked, he was muttering and swearing away. And the impression that this really gave was, this man is out of his depth. And I think we saw that, especially when things went wrong in the quarter-final against Holland. Because one of the prime duties of the coach is to set the emotional tone for the team. And Dunga was hammering away at the dugout, and he was yelling at the referee, and every decision was a tantrum. And part of this emotional breakdown, if you like, I think was caused by the very strained relationship that he'd had with the press over the past 4 years. So I think Mano Menezes has learnt from Dunga's failure, and he's certainly trying harder to keep the press on side, because in a society like Brazil, which is very, very open to the media, it doesn't do the national team any good. The national team coach, he's sitting in a coconut shy anyway. He's going to have lots of things thrown at him. If he tries to go to war with the media, he's not going to win, and he's only going to bring added pressure on himself. So I don't think that there'll be leeway from Manuel for the players to go out partying too much. But I think there will be more leeway to try and keep the press on side.
He's left Corinthians, but Corinthians are still doing very, very well in the table, topping the Brazilian championship at the moment.
Yeah, I sat up till 4 o'clock yesterday watching them beat Santos 3-2. And doing well without Mano Menezes, who's obviously joined the national team, and without Ronaldo, who still isn't fit, should be fit soon. It's nip and tuck with Fluminense, and Fluminense have a very, very deep squad. And one of the talking points in Rio football, where I usually live, is there's a sponsor. It's a private health scheme behind Fluminense who are paying the salaries of many of these players. Quite where the return is going to come from, because they've bought Deco from Chelsea, they've bought Belletti back from Chelsea into a squad that's already quite strong. Fregi, the former Lyon centre forward. So Fluminense have a very, very strong squad, perhaps a stronger squad on paper even than Corinthians. But there's a long way to go yet. And one of the things I think with the South American leagues is that they don't have the same kind of predictability as the major European leagues. So a lot can happen between now and then.
If you're talking unpredictable leagues, I mean, Argentina has to be one where you've got all these... But Argentinos Juniors were last champions, and now they're right down the bottom. It seems to be that there's a continual churn of champions over in Argentina at the moment.
It has been over recent years. They have two entirely separate championships per year, and the last eight championships have been won by eight different teams. So totally unpredictable. And part of that is the length of the season, because it's only 19 games... the teams playing each other once, and always the shorter the competition, the greater there is the chance of an upset. You know, the longer the competition, the more your major powers are going to come through. But really, in Argentina at the moment, you're in a situation where everyone is selling all the time. There's no continuity. And Argentina Juniors, as you said, won the championship May, June. That side has already been broken up. And the current side are second from bottom. That's been the way of all the smaller sides have come through. And that the space for the smaller sides to come through is left open by the fact that the big sides are themselves continually selling their best players. And they also have to deal with the pressures of being a big side. Because the pressures from the fans, young players being promoted into the first team to replace someone who's just been sold, and straight away they have to deal with this pressure from some of the most passionate fans in the world. And it's not everyone who can do that. So you have everyone in a permanent state of transition. I think certainly after, you know, I've been here for a few weeks now and I've managed to catch a few games. I think in this situation, the Argentinian League and the English League are dead opposites. The English League right at the top has astonishing quality, but the price that you pay for this is predictability. The Argentinian League, totally unpredictable, but the price you pay for that is a lack of quality because the good players are always being sold.
Interesting situation at the moment in Argentina, Chris, with River Plate, who, they're... might well win the championship, win the Apertura, but they could well be relegated at the same time.
Yes, which I wasn't aware of until I read a piece by our esteemed pod colleague this week. But it's amazing, and it's something that you talk about a lot, is this strange system with relegation. And yet there hasn't really been anything in the last few years that I've been paying attention to Argentinian football where it's really come home quite as much as it might be about to.
Well, I think that's because it's River Plate, who are one of the big two, and they've won many more titles than anyone else. As I said, it's a short season, 19 games, but relegation is decided over six seasons or 3 years on an average of points. Now, this is blatantly done in order to favour the big teams, because with the big teams in a state of flux, just like anyone else, the big teams are always subject to the possibility of a bad championship. So the way that you try and protect them from that is by making the relegation as long as possible. Do it over 3 years. But River Plate have had two very bad years in a row. So that they go into this season, which is now seven rounds old, they go into this season well behind the rest of the field. Now, they're doing very well. Had they won on Sunday, they lost 1-0 to Newell's Old Boys. Had they won, they would be top of the table. They didn't win, so that they're sixth, but they're only 2 points off the top of the table. But on the relegation thing, they're third from bottom. Now, if they do manage to win the championship, they then can't go down. They are protected that way. And I think it's very unlikely that they will go down. They've still got the rest of this season, so that's 12 games this season, and the complete following season, that's 19 games. So they've still got 31 games to acquire enough points to save themselves. I think it's an odds-on certainty. I think that they will be able to save themselves. But it is a bizarre position, and certainly to English fans, it's almost unbelievable that a side can be fighting on two fronts at the same time.
Early days, obviously, in the Argentinian Championship. San Lorenzo top, but it's tight, as it always is. Who would be your pick of the teams from Argentina this season?
To be honest, I don't think there's a great deal of quality about. Maybe San Lorenzo, Ramon Diaz, who I think had a spell here with Oxford a few years back, is a coach of vast experience and a winning coach, and he's got a reasonably strong squad. Vélez Sarsfield are a good side as well, and Ricardo Gareca, their coach, also has a very good track record. And one thing I think is certain is that it won't be decided three or four rounds before. It'll go right down to the wire. So, all right, lack of quality, yes, but in compensation, you do get excitement with nothing being decided probably until the last day of the season.
We have a feature on twofootedtackle.com every week. We pick out six games across the entire globe. If you go to twofootedtackle.com, at some point tomorrow, it'll be up when I've written it. It's still midway through, but we've picked out one from the Argentinian league from this weekend, of Estudiantes versus Boca, which we think could be the pick of the games from the Argentinian.
Hell of a game. Boca of new coach Claudio Borghi, who won the championship last season with Argentinos Juniors. He's trying to impose a new system. He's very much a kind of 3-4-1-2 man. So it's a new system that Boca are still trying to get used to. And there are a lot of injuries there with Boca as well. There's the Riquelme thing. Riquelme almost overshadows the entire club, and whether it's worthwhile to pay him the amount that they're committed to paying him for the next 4 years, that's another discussion entirely. But a number of other injuries through the squad. Estudiantes, Alejandro Sabella, well known to supporters of Leeds United and Sheffield United, because he played here, took up coaching in his mid-50s because he was always the assistant to Daniel Passarella. It's comparatively recently, only last year, that he went out for the first time on his own with Estudiantes and has done very, very well. They've just lost a few players as well. They've lost players to England, for example. Boselli at Wigan. Angeleri has gone to Sunderland. So he's now trying to rebuild his team. So two teams in transition, and yeah, that unpredictability factor of Argentinian football. I won't be betting on this with my money. I'll have to use some of yours, I think, Gary.
Is there a future job for him at River Plate, given Passarella's role there?
It's certainly a possibility, and there's been a lot of speculation that he's the front man for the Argentinian national team. Although caretaker coach Sergio Batista did his claims no harm whatsoever, beating world champion Spain 4-1. A couple of weeks ago, so you would imagine it would be hard for Batista to lose that position now. Although there's the Copa America next year, so that, and Argentina will be the hosts of the Copa America. So if Batista keeps the job until then and does badly, there's always the possibility that Sabella will step into that position. But I think you're entirely right with the long term future there at River Plate. They have an excellent coach at the moment. One of my favourite coaches, Angel Capa, who's an old time idealist. He likes playing football the right way, and that's bang in tune with the ethos of River Plate. That's the way that River Plate like to operate. But with Passarella there as president, and Passarella came in on a lovely slogan, I thought. He said that what he wants to do there at River Plate, because River Plate have been in crisis for a number of years, administrative crisis, not just crisis on the field. In fact, I think the crisis on the field is probably a reflection of the crisis off the field. And Passarella came in as president with the slogan that he wants to Europeanise the club administration and South Americanise the club's football. I think at the moment, with Angel Capa, he's got a coach very much in the best traditions of South American football. But Alejandro Sabella is, in the long term, perhaps an equally good bet to carry forward the tradition of this great club.
James is nodding along when you mentioned Leeds, because obviously James is a big Leeds fan.
Up in Leeds, we know him as Alex Sabella. Right. And we also know him as a pretty ropey player, generally. I mean, he didn't really make an enormous
I think he did better
impact
with Sheffield United, didn't he?
Yeah, I think that's probably why we dislike him. But yeah, and nice to hear that Leeds is spreading all over the world, tentacles being wrapped around Argentinian football as well.
Just briefly, if we're talking Argentinian football, obviously you've got to mention the World Cup with Maradona as well over there. James, just quickly to you, what did you make of Maradona over the World Cup, now that we've had a chance to look back and assess on there? And I think we had you in quite soon afterwards, so you've had a bit of time to think about that.
Yeah, we've all had time to digest the mad ramblings and crazy behaviour of Maradona in South Africa. Looking back on it, you know, as a neutral and as someone who enjoyed watching Argentina a hell of a lot, I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. I wouldn't have wanted anyone else to be there. Having said that, I think that we've all realised that Maradona's limitations as a tactical coach and as somebody who was able to influence games from the touchline have been, you know, more than demonstrated by their quarterfinal defeat against Germany. And I think that obviously questions have been asked post Maradona about, you know, the extent of his role. What exactly was he doing? Was he, you know, the brains behind the operation, or a kind of a cheerleader, you know, a sort of a glorified kind of, you know, drum basher on the sidelines? And, you know, the result that Sergio Batista had, as Tim points out, the 4-1 victory over Spain, probably has done quite a lot to sort of shake off the kind of longings for Maradona to come back in Argentina, I would say. And I think that, you know, the chances of him coming back now are pretty slim to none.
Was it something that perhaps Argentina just needed to get out of their system, and now they can go back? They don't have that shadow of Diego ever probably coming back as coach again.
Well, I think that was a deal from the point of view of the Argentinian FA, to be honest. I think it was in a way it was a trap, because if you look at Argentina since Menotti was appointed in 1974, they haven't sacked coaches. Coaches have had a 4-year cycle, and they've only left if they've resigned. What they had with this time with Maradona, because his predecessor Alfio Basile resigned towards the end of the World Cup qualifying cycle, the Argentinian FA had the chance to appoint Maradona for about a year and a half, just over a year and a half. And two things could happen. He could be successful, and then the Argentinian FA could bask in the glory, or he could fail, and then the Argentinian FA could have drawn the sting of one of their fiercest critics, and potentially a loose cannon and an uncontrollable cannon. So I think the Argentinian FA have got out of it very, very nicely. It was always going to be fascinating to see how Maradona was going to get on in the World Cup. And he went from having a team that just 2 or 3 months before the competition looked to be ultra cautious to a team which in the midst of the competition became a team that was way, way too attacking and had no balance whatsoever. I think it was always going to be, as perhaps Maradona himself might have put it before the competition, a kind of suck it and see type situation. And one of the things that we learned from his performances as a coach and subsequently from what Sergio Batista has done, because he went away to Ireland before the win over Spain, is that midfield isn't an optional extra in a team. You know, you can go to a coffee shop and they'll say, would you like a bit of chocolate on top of your cappuccino? And that's an optional extra. Having a midfield is not an optional extra. And if he had a midfield against Germany, it might have been a different story. He had the warning. He had the warning against Mexico. I think you can really draw a parallel here between his side and Scolari's Brazil in 2002, who had a very easy group and went with an attacking side. They went with Juninho, the former Middlesbrough man, in their midfield, really because the group was so easy. First second round game was Belgium. Brazil thought they would roll Belgium over very easily, and it became a very difficult game. Belgium had a clearly correct goal, wrongly disallowed. Brazil scored with the help of a deflection and won 2-0. But really, I think Belgium were probably the better side. But it was a big warning that Brazil received. So straight away, Juninho was dropped. In came Kleberson to tighten up the midfield. Now, Argentina had something fairly similar against Mexico. And Argentina got lucky breaks there with the Tevez goal that should never have been given. Mexico had their chances, but then so one lucky goal and one defensive error, and suddenly Argentina were home and dry. But the warning signs were flashing against Mexico, and they weren't heeded. You kind of think if Maradona could have his time again, he would do things very differently, because his side went to Germany, in Germany, at the end of March, and they won 1-0, and the Germans had one shot on goal in the 90 minutes. So Maradona was capable of more. But the World Cup is like time speeded up, and it requires you to have an emotional balance. And look at the example of, say, North Korea. They played very well against Brazil. Everyone is praising them. So what do they do for the second game? They go out to play against Portugal. They couldn't do it. They weren't good enough to do it. They couldn't cope with the emotional roller coaster of the World Cup. Nor, unfortunately, could Diego Maradona as a coach.
Well, one emotional roller coaster, and we haven't got time to mention to go into him in detail, but I'll mention it anyway, because I know Chris will love me to mention Martin Palermo. If you didn't Patrick. Have Diego, you wouldn't have Palermo at the World Cup. And I was sat next to that man when Palermo scored, and he went absolutely... I think he was channeling the spirit of every Argentinian at that moment.
Seemed to be. I'm surprised I wasn't kicked out of the pub, actually.
OK, we'll leave it there for part one. Stay tuned for part two. We'll be heading north to the USA before hopping across Asia all the way to Russia. Plus, we'll be getting an extra man in the pod. Welcome back, part two of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Welcome to Andy Brassel.
Hello.
He's made it. Hello, Andy.
At last.
You have. Apologies. You're going to miss Wimbledon Crawley tonight.
I'm going to miss the first half. I'm just inspired by, I remember going to Millwall Wimbledon in the FA Cup last year and David Hay turning up in the second half. So you've got to be a real star to turn up that late, I reckon.
There was one a couple of years ago, was watching Dagenham and the game was called off at half time because of floodlight failure. Freezing cold, horrible, horrible day. And a load of Exeter fans turned up at half time on a rented minibus because theirs had broken down. Anyway, a couple of listener questions before we get into the rest of the second half. Real FA Cup has asked, what FA Cup shocks do you think there'll be this weekend? Is of course, a second qualifying round, isn't it, Chris, this yep. weekend? Any FA Cup shocks that you've picked out?
Well, I'm going to avoid the obvious one.
Okay.
Because I have a friend who said he will eat his hat if that's not my choice.
Is that Tooting Staines, by any chance?
It might be.
Okay.
But I'm going to have a real punt on Stourbridge to win at Telford.
Ooh.
Divisions difference.
Okay.
Telford in form.
That could be interesting. That could be interesting.
That is also wishful thinking a little bit as well. That's one for Mrs. Chris.
Okay. My pick for this weekend would be possibly Sheffield to upset Northwich Victoria. Highlighted that on the pod last week. Northwich topping the Evo Stick Premier at the moment. Sheffield division below and mid-table, but they're at home. Northwich know what it's like to knock a big team out of the cup after Charlton last year, so they should heed the warning signs. Another question. Tim Morgan, 7 goals in 6. Has there ever been a greater example of football robbery than the Swans nabbing Scott Sinclair for £500,000? James?
Well, it looks a great signing, doesn't it? I actually have been doing some research on Lucas Radderby, formerly of Leeds. There's a biography of him just about to be released, and so I've decided to read around him before I plunge into it. He was signed for £250,000 from Kaiser Chiefs in 1994 by Howard Wilkinson, and is certainly one of, if not the best defenders that I've ever seen, ever, full stop. So $250,000 for one of the best defenders ever, that's a snip, isn't it?
If you're looking for snips, Shinji Kagawa at Borussia Dortmund is looking fantastic. Mm. Absolutely brilliant. Andy, I don't know if you've seen much of him at all.
Yeah, a little bit. Obviously not as close quarters as you, Gary. I'm sure we've discussed this before from your trip to Dortmund. But yeah, tremendous. Again, at the weekend, good couple of goals against Schalke and the big Rhein-Ruhr derby up there. So he's a real surprise package.
Yeah, coming from Japanese second division, I think. And definitely, I can't remember the exact fee. I think something like 350.
I think I can safely say that Japanese second division is off my patch.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite on anybody's patch. Okay.
How about John Carew for Milan Baroš?
Let's move on to MLS.
I can tell you that wasn't a good deal for Leon.
Who was the boss? Gerard Houllier.
Kelsey Freeze.
Okay, let's move on to look at all things MLS, which is at least one of our patches. Chris, all the talks about the Galaxy and the Crew most weeks on the pod. At the moment, Real Salt Lake continuing to set MLS records. They're now unbeaten 23 home games.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it?
It's fantastic.
Very good home
yeah.
form. The kind of home form you would expect from the champions, really, even though they didn't play like champions for much of last season. They are really looking the part this term, and they could well go on all the way again.
Back-to-back MLS Cups?
It's possible. I don't think they will do it, but they will go some distance into the playoffs, I would say.
Probably result of the weekend. We do talk about the Crew most weeks about how imperious they are in rolling over opposition, but they lost 4-0 at home to the Sounders.
Yeah, a bit of a bounce back for the Sounders, isn't it, last couple of weeks after we started to pan them a little bit, which we often do. It's been ever since we started this show, we've cursed MLS teams. Blaise Nkufo scoring a hat-trick, finally getting his first MLS goal, and he got 3 at once.
Mm. Elsewhere, Donovan getting a brace against DC United.
Yes, heartbreaking brace is the official term for that. Andy Nahar scored the first one for DC, and it was looking very good. And Donovan can pop up with goals like that for fun, and he did with two, and LA go marching on.
Probably, if you wanted goals this week in the MLS, Kansas City against Houston, 4-3 on there. Wizards, obviously, the Eastern Conference, they're now the third-place team in there. Do you think they've got an outside chance of making the playoffs?
Yeah, well, if you look at the table now, they're only 3 points short. I think they might be just a little bit shy of it when it comes to the end of the season. I think it's starting to look like there will be 6 teams from the other division. It's one of the 2 games I haven't seen on that list, because it was last night.
And a game that we might, some listeners might have already seen or know the result of by the time we get to it, but Galaxy Red Bulls is the game this week. I mean, that's probably one of the big ones.
Yeah, it's a much hyped game, obviously, because you've got some of the star players of the league in there, one of whom will be missing. Mr. Henry is injured at the moment, hilariously, after injuring Kevin Hartman by booting him after a goal earlier in the week.
I've picked out from in the six to pick this week Real Salt Lake against Colorado, which I think should be fascinating game, that one, because Colorado, not an easy team at all. One of those ones that really carry on there, keep on getting results out, always seem to be there at the end of the season.
Yeah, they're doing all right. They're looking good for the playoffs. But as we've mentioned earlier already, Real Salt Lake's home form is excellent. I think he might be having a bit of a punt there on one of the six best games in the world at the weekend.
No, I'm just picking out the one that might be interesting, and I've picked it out on the basis of Salt Lake's home form.
Yeah, dark horse, Kansas City, Dallas.
Yeah, I was looking at that. I think Dallas third in the Western, Kansas third in the Eastern. Where do you see that one going?
I would think that Kansas City might just edge it.
Okay, fair enough. Dallas had a 2-2 draw at the Revs, though, so...
Not bad. That's not a great result given the Revs' form this season. But Dallas are looking fairly decent-ish at the moment, playing a lot better than they have for the last couple of years, and starting to put the points on the board as well.
It's not going to be long until we're starting merging the conferences when we're looking at the table. So it's getting now to the business end in MLS. Of course, we'll be back to have a quick look at it next week. Let's leave it behind, though. Look at another world superpower in Russia. Now, if you read reports from European competitions, you might notice a distinctly lot of un-Russian names in the matchday squads. James, as our resident Eastern European expert on the pod, can you explain why Russian clubs and other Eastern European clubs are so fond of buying South Americans, especially Brazilians?
Well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward logic. You buy a Brazilian from, you know, their domestic championship, don't tend to cost too much, and all of a sudden everyone starts talking about how their club is going to be playing samba football. It gets people coming through the turnstiles, and it gets a lot of people talking about the club. Obviously, the reality often works out very different. As for every notable Brazilian success there has been in the Russian leagues, and in fact, as you alluded to, South American success in general, the Argentines make up a notable number of the imports into the Russian league as well. There are a hell of a lot of failures. An enormous number who really disappoint. So it's a gamble by Russian teams, but a calculated one.
A gamble, and then you look at the climate. You probably couldn't get much more different than a very cold Russia and Brazil.
Well, that's right. The first question: whenever a new South American signs for a Russian team, and is paraded in front of the press, and obviously they've got translators there or interpreters to allow them to communicate. First question is always, you know, what do you notice about the weather? And whenever you see the video of the of these interviews taking place, the translator always asks the question in Portuguese or Spanish with a little smirk in his face, a little glint in his eye, because he knows exactly what's coming. Because the answer is always, we hate it. We absolutely hate it. They arrive and they're not prepared for, particularly as the Russian off season, for now at least, that's a different story, is between end of November and beginning of February. The transfer window for Russian clubs tends to be the big sort of buying season is right in the coldest time of the year. So of course these players come out of South America and land in Russia for pre-season training in December, January, or just to sign their contracts. And it's the coldest time of year. They've never experienced minus 40 degrees in Moscow before, and it's a real shock to them.
Tim, do you find it a bit odd that South Americans seem to find Russia a destination, a fairly regular destination?
Money, it's a hit. Don't give me that do goody good.
I was just thinking I need a shave, actually.
that's where the money is, and Russia pays good corn, and they'll follow the money. I remember talking to a Brazilian centre back who was based in Russia on a plastic pitch that wasn't doing his knee any good at all. But he wasn't going to come out of there because he was earning good money. So they know it's a short career, And if Russia is coming up with the money, that they'll go there. There has been a new development in Brazil recently with the Russian Championship is now broadcast in Brazil. And it is like kind of 7 o'clock in the morning, so you know, sorry, we're closed. But I think the national team manager will be paying attention because there are some high-profile Brazilians, Alex, lovely little left-footed attacking midfielder, who wasn't far off the World Cup squad, and he's in Russia at the moment. And I believe there's an issue going on at the moment with a Brazilian, a very interesting striker, Wellington, who perhaps would like to represent the Russian national team.
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right, Tim, to pick out Alex Meschini and Wellington as the two kind of top names at the moment amongst the Brazilian contingent in Russia. Alex is almost without exception the best player in the Russian Premier League. I'd probably put a couple of others up there with him, but certainly he is among them. And Russians are very excited of the idea that a player from their domestic league is attracting enough attention that they may even be called up to the Brazilian national team. The last time that happened, I think, was the Confederations Cup when Brazil called up Wagner Love and Daniel Carvalho. Unfortunately, their careers are kind of immediately after that took a real nosedive. I think Carvalho put on about 4 stone, and Wagner Love decided he didn't fancy another Russian winter and hopped it off to I think Palmeiras he was playing for last season,
And then Flamengo, and didn't want to go back.
Yeah, he's gone back now. But the real excitement is about Alex in that it's the first time since those two players were picked up in 2007. By the Brazilian national team that all eyes are on the Russian league again. But to return to the issue of Wellington, I've written a little bit about this, and it's a real it probably reflects more on the Russian championship and Russian mentalities than it does on Brazilian ones, because as far as Wellington's concerned, he's pretty certain he's only 23, by the way. He's pretty certain he won't be muscling into the Brazil squad anytime soon, despite the fact that he scored 46 league goals and 66 league appearances.
I think the thing that the drawback for him there is that he played for Goiás, which is a if you like kind of Norwich City of Brazilian football, and that didn't give him much of a profile, much of a platform, because and from the moment that he came through, he's quick, he's two-footed, he's the kind of player that had he represented, say, Flamengo or Corinthians, and if he had a lobby behind him, then I think he would perhaps have a chance of a Brazil call-up. But it's much harder to do it when you started with an unfashionable club and didn't represent a big club in Brazil.
Sure. I mean, the current situation with Wellington's still very much up in the air. He seems to have acquired himself a willing Russian woman to perhaps oil the wheels of bureaucracy and enable him to pick up a passport pretty soon. She's a very exciting young lady, I must say. She was a reality TV star in Russia's version of Big Brother. I would say attractive, but I'm not sure how much of her is real and how much of her has been added on later. The real debate, to return to slightly more serious issues, is there is a kind of identity issue that Russia is still grappling with about what constitutes a good patriot and what constitutes somebody who is, you know, deserving, let's say, of a call-up to, after all, their, you know, prize, you know, winning Russian national team. And they are yet to really warm to the idea that somebody who wasn't born on Russia's shores is able to somehow, you know, muster the required energies and passion for turning out for their national team. But I think if he carries on scoring the way he has done, he has 15 goals in 16 appearances this season. He will probably, the pressure on Dick Advocaat to select him may become too great to ignore.
Any other South Americans we should look out for in that league, James?
Well, absolutely loads. I think I was having a quick count up today, and I think I noticed just Brazilians alone, I think there's about 30 playing in the Russian Premier League. And we're not just talking the real stars. I mean, there are some stars. I've already mentioned Alex and Wellington. Spartak also have a defensive midfield player called Ibsen, who was actually at Porto. I don't know if you remember him, Andy.
I do remember him, yeah.
Ibsen has really, really matured into a fantastic Russian Premier League player. He actually... I wrote this when I was feeling a little bit highfalutin. He's the yin to Alex's yang. He's the destroyer and Alex is the creator in that Spartak midfield. He's been fantastic. We've alluded to Wagner Love. He's back scoring goals for CSKA Moscow. The one other player that I'd like to point out, and it's purely because he's a sort of a favourite of mine, and he's by no means a wonderful, you know, talented individual. There's an Argentine, I think he's about 30, 31 now, called Hector Bracamonte, who has been playing, he's been knocking around the Russian leagues for some time now. He played, I think, for FC Moscow. He's now at Terek Grozny. And he's really a cult figure. If you can find a picture of him, he's got enormous sort of like a lion's mane of hair with two kind of pigtails that are kind of sort of rotten hair kind of like falling out the back. It's the strangest hairstyle I've ever seen. And he's a striker. And every time he scores, he does like really the most awful celebration I've ever seen, where he pretends to be an aeroplane. So just purely for cult value alone, Hector Bracamonte is one to watch out for.
Fantastic. Okay, I don't think we're going to top anything else from this section. So we'll leave part two there. Part three, we'll conclude our global journey. We'll stop by Portugal, stock up with some duty-free in France, and head back to the Premier League. And that's coming up after this. And welcome back. Part three of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Let's have a quick look at a couple of Andy's favourite countries. Andy, fascinating games in France at the moment, most of them involving Lyon.
Yes, well, the big one at the weekend I was actually at. I was in Bordeaux for Johan Gourcuff's return to his old club with his new one, Lyon. And of course, this was the big transfer, the biggest transfer ever between two French clubs, 22 million. And Gourcuff really has held a lot of the hope of the country going forward, both as the sort of new Zidane at Bordeaux, because of course Zidane really built his reputation at Bordeaux, and the fact that he propelled Bordeaux to do well in the Champions League, to win the championship for the first time in 10 years in 2009. And people, I think, expected him to leave Bordeaux at some point, but perhaps for another big European club. It didn't quite work out for him at Milan before, because he was in close rivalry with Kaká, and there was only one player who was ever going to win that. So it was such a disappointment, I think, to Bordeaux fans, A, that his form tailed off in the last 6 months and they dropped out of the European places, and B, that he ended up going to Lyon. These are two big bourgeois cities in France who are big rivals for that reason, because they kind of closely resemble each other, and they're just out of that PSG and Marseille clique at the top. And so really there's a lot of bad blood between them going back for a number of years. And he got a really quite hostile reception. He was whistled every time he went anywhere near the ball. There were a big stack of about 200 or 300 fans waiting to welcome Lyon's coach as it arrived, and chant various upsetting stuff at Gourcuff. And you know, he's as well as an outrageously talented player, he's actually quite a quiet guy. You know, he doesn't really like talking to the press, he's not very comfortable with media attention, so this whole thing has been a real challenge to him. And even though Lyon were terrible, as is part of the course, and lost quite deservedly, Bordeaux were very merited winners, Gourcuff actually did okay in the bits where he got the ball. He looked Lyon's best hope in a way, but they're really hoping to build a team around him. And really, it's a big question what they'll do from here, where they'll go from here, because you know, their starting lineup on Sunday cost 132 million euros, and of course they got to the semi-finals of the Champions League last season, but without playing a lot of good football, and they look a long way short this season.
And I mean, I get this weekend's game, you'd expect the positions to be reversed. They've obviously got the derby against Saint-Etienne, and Lyon, you'd expect to be up the top. Saint-Etienne consistently 17th over the last few seasons.
Beautifully put.
But this season, complete role reversal there.
It's incredible. They're top of the league for the first time since 1981, which was when they were in their pomp with Michel Platini and under the table payments to players. So it's a really big thing, and I don't think people realise sometimes outside France what a big club St Etienne are. You know, they're really fervently followed. They were the first French team in the age of televised football. Of course, Stade de Reims were in the first couple of European Cup finals against Real Madrid when they had Raymond Kopa before he went off to the Bernabeu. But they were the first team in the televised era in 1976 to get into the European Cup final. They had so many great games at their Geoffroy Guichard stadium. So they're really passionately followed, and people associate them with a nostalgic, more pure time of football. So a lot of people are very excited about St Etienne being up there. But they haven't beaten Lyon in the derby since 1994, and the famous St Etienne president of their glory years, Roger Rocher, he once said, in football terms, Lyon will always be the suburb and St Etienne will always be the city. And they've gone completely the other way, like proving him completely wrong since then. He must be spinning in his grave at some of the derbies that have gone on over the last couple of years. And, you know, this is really boot on the other foot. They won't have a better chance to go to Lyon and break that sorry sequence.
Okay, well, let's move on to a league we very rarely cover, actually. I think we've had it once before on here when John from Just Football was on. That's Portugal. Andy, you've been over there as well. You took in Benfica. What were your thoughts on the Eagles?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Eagles, actually, because the best moment of any Benfica home game is they have this eagle, which is the club mascot, Vitória, an actual proper eagle, and it's released from the top of the stadium. They play some quite rousing music, and it flies round the stadium in ever-decreasing circles. And there's this man who's the eagle keeper at the bottom, who's a sort of man in his like mid to late 40s in a full Benfica kit. And he has this Lexan with the club crest on, and he beckons the eagle forth, sort of in the manner of Vic Reeves in Shooting Stars, to like land on the lectern. And of course, every home game, he lands on the lectern, and he gets on his knees and punches the air, and everyone applauds wildly.
Why don't Crystal Palace do that?
Well, I believe
do with a sparrow.
I believe Lazio have actually just done something similar, but I think that health and safety people have got involved with that and said that the eagle has to, you know, remain sort of locked up for everyone's health and safety.
Well, I don't think that's very fair on the eagle.
But not quite the same, because Cologne, you've got a goat over there as well. They're on their eighth goat at Cologne.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened to the other seven?
They just died. They just died of old age. No, they weren't sacrificed or anything, but they have... it's to do with their club's badge. They have a goat was presented to the president back in, I think, the 50s. And
you see it milling around side the pitch. Yeah. It's very bizarre. I don't think that had come off the top deck of the stand.
No, not at all. It's not quite on the same level. But animals aside...
Well, you have to do something, of course, to herald the coming of Pablo Aimar. It's always a real pleasure to watch him. And he was back in great form when I was over there for the Champions League game against Apollon Tel Aviv. Of course, it was their debut in the Champions League proper. And they were very impressive, admittedly, against a team that will probably be the whipping boys of the group. They're in there with Lyon and Schalke as well. But Aimar was absolutely terrific. He was really at his best, and he was so important for Benfica last season. Of course, they scored over 100 goals in all competitions, and they had him at the tip of a diamond midfield, and again drawing players to him, running with the ball. You can understand, of course, like Maradona's anointed several new Maradonas over the years, some better considered than others, but there are real moments where you thought, you know, you could really see what he was getting at. And you know, I think there's a real feeling that Aimar's battling against the dying of the light. He's suffered so many physical problems while he's been in the European game. He's struggled to stay fit. He's still pretty fragile, but nevertheless, I think he's found a good league in Portugal. It's not quite as physical as, say, Spain or France or somewhere like that, where he does get that bit of space, and they've got good muscle in the midfield, the like of Carlos Martins and Javi García, who is their sort of point man, their sentinel, to sort of protect him and let him get on with doing what he does best.
Have they replaced Di Maria?
That they have, with Nicolas Gaitán.
Different player.
Of course, very, very different.
Skillful, but the comparison I would think is that Di Maria is a flyer.
Mm.
He likes the ball in front of him and he'll bomb onto it. Gaitán, he prefers the ball more to feet.
Well, of course, that's something that Benfica are very good at, keeping hold of the ball. I think the thing with Gaetan, he's more of a replacement for the new Di Maria, if you like. Because when Di Maria arrived at the league at first, he always got stuck out on the right wing. And he never looked comfortable there at all, never. And what really brought it out of him and brought real consistency out of him and a real threat out of him is playing him on the left. So he sort of got used to taking people on the outside, becoming a bit more daring. And that's just something that concerns me about him going to Real Madrid, that, you know, he's going to get stuck on the right too much. Of course, there is a possibility that him and Cristiano Ronaldo can swap over. So that's something that could help him build his game. But I tend to think he moved a little too soon to Real Madrid. You know, he'd only just established himself as a key player in the Benfica first team. But
where did Gaetan play?
He played on the left side, actually.
Because Boca groomed him. He was a huge hope at Boca, and they groomed him first as an old-fashioned number 10. And then he's a little left-footed player. And then they'd moved him wide right to cut in and send over big loopy crosses for the big striker, Palermo. Now, Benfica have a big striker of their own, Cardozo. Yes. So when they bought Gaetan, I wondered if that would be his role. Out right, cutting in onto the left foot for crosses for Cardozo at the far post.
Well, I think he's more about dipping in crosses quite early. In the same sort of way that Beckham does. He's not the sort of player who's going to beat three or four men, I don't think. But he's someone who they expect to whip the ball in early. Still, he has to get a bit of stamina, I think, to make an impression over the full 90 minutes. They've been making him play for an hour and dragging him off. But he's had a few decent games so far. So it looks relatively promising.
Porto topping the league at the moment. How do you think they've got the capacity to stay the pace up there in Portugal?
I think they possibly have, and I think one of the most exciting things about them, one of the most exciting things about a lot of the top teams in Portugal at the moment, is their coaches. Of course, they have André Villas-Boas, who took over this season. He's only 33 years old, but he's been the assistant to José Mourinho at both Chelsea and Inter. So, you know, there's a touch of special one magic about him. And him and Domingos Paciência at Braga are the two young managers who are really making it happen in the Portuguese league at the moment. But it's impressive how Villas-Boas has taken to Porto, which is his hometown team, so it's a great source of pride, him being manager, but how he's managed to put his stamp on the team quite quickly. Now, there was a thought under Gesualdo that even though he was such an important manager for them in the post-Mourinho climate, that he let the team drift a little bit, and, you know, he ruled with a real rod of iron. But nevertheless, there was the thought they might need a sort of younger, fresher sort of mind to move on, and that's exactly what Villas-Boas is. And very much like under Mourinho, they play very much with his personality. You know, that they're pressing a lot higher up, they're a lot fitter, they're round the pitch very quickly, and they're transferring the ball around the pitch very quickly, and they can do that because they've got wide men of the likes of Ulk and Varela as well, and João Moutinho, of course, in the middle. He's looking the player he always should have been in the first half of the season, first half of his career, sorry. And really, it's going to be very, very difficult to see anyone overtaking them this season, especially when Benfica have lost three out of the first four, and Porto have won all of the first four.
Of course, you mentioned Braga there. Braga did great guns last season, and Tim, you saw them this season at Arsenal, and they were completely outplayed over at the Emirates.
Well, it was, you know, Andy mentioning Domingos, who I remember as a player with Porto, now the young coach, and after the game, he looked like he'd been run over by a truck. You know, it was fascinating for me to be there. And prior to that, the previous Champions League game I'd been to was when it was before it was called the Champions League. It was the old European Cup. I was at the final of Barcelona-Sampdoria in 92 at the old Wembley, and just how English football at the elite level has changed since then, and what Arsenal did with the movement of the ball, moving the ball with pace and precision. It was absolutely breathtaking. I was in the press box at Arsenal, which is quite low, which accentuates the pace of the thing. And for the first few minutes, I was as bemused as the Braga players. And they're basically a kind of defensive counter-attacking side. I think that's their primary characteristic. But and poor old Mangino, the Brazilian captain. And he couldn't get close to Fabregas to throw sand at his backside, you know, and the ball was just being moved with such speed and such precision. The Wiltshire's just I've seen him twice now in just over a week, and he's a special, special player, as is Fabregas, you know, the sorcerer and his apprentice. And the movement of the ball was sensational. I loved a player I've heard Andy talk about a lot over the years, Shamak, up front. And Wenger after the game was saying that he's a midfielder as well as a striker. And he gives so many options for the midfield, because if you're going to play that formation, that one up front, he has to be versatile. He has to be able to receive back to goal. He has to be able to receive behind the line as well. And the standard of the thing was way, way too high for Braga, I'm afraid.
Mm. How do you think Braga will do this season, Andy?
Well, they've still got their home games, of course. And I think it's more if they can psychologically get over what happened to them at Arsenal. I mean, it was exactly what Tim said. They were completely shell-shocked afterwards. They were completely out of it. And they need to get over that pretty quickly, I think. But they do have home games. And I don't think either Shakhtar or Partizan are that much better than them, that they can feel they don't have any chance at all. I'd be interested to know James's view on Shakhtar, because of course they've started Champions League campaigns very, very well before, but without actually breaking into the last 16.
Mm. Well, obviously, putting aside Shakhtar's experiences in the Champions League, they obviously, you know, had a fantastic run in the second competition a couple of years back, and I mentioned this on the pod, I think it was last week, that they've lost Fernandinho for the season with a leg break, and it's always going to be tough for Shakhtar, because you know, they aren't used to playing the level of competition domestically that, you know, allows them to get used to playing the likes of Arsenal week in, week out. And they have two big games a season, basically home and away against Dynamo Kiev. So really, they need to use their home advantage to best effect. Nobody likes going to Donetsk. It's a very, very long way.
And apart from Beyonce.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you're invited by a billionaire oligarch, you don't really say no, do you? The owner of Shakhtar Donetsk, Rinat Akhmetov, is obviously a big Seoul fan. As I say, they need to use home advantage. Donetsk is a pretty grey, miserable industrial city. It was, all the way through the Soviet period, a coal mining and steel kind of city. It's generally a pretty unwelcoming place. And if they can use that to their psychological effect and they win their home games, that stands them in good stead. I think the same can be said, actually, to broaden the point, about most of the sort of Eastern European sides, that, you know, you take 9 points from your group games purely on home matches, once you get to the knockout stages, you then reach the point where all sorts of other factors come in, you know, psychological mood and form and how individual players play on a single night, because it's no longer a group stage. We're talking about knockout stages over two legs. So Shakhtar have got a chance. I would actually disagree with you, purely on bias. I don't think Braga are at the level of Shakhtar Donetsk, but
well, I think on the price of their players, I mean, there's clearly no comparison. I mean, Braga's whole squad costs €350,000. So that's a pretty big difference there. But Arsenal have actually got a really terrible record away in the Ukraine, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, with Arsenal, you just don't know, because they go out and play home matches at the Emirates in the group stage of the Champions League and just destroy teams, and Braga being the latest example. They're finding it difficult to shake off the whole flaky kind of possession merchant but no substance when it comes to big games kind of tag.
Are we on the brink of comparing Sunderland to the Ukraine?
Well, same kind of miserable place, I think.
Yeah, I must say, you hang around in Consett or County Durham and you might be able to draw some kind of, you know, aesthetic comparisons with Darkest Donetsk. So maybe you're onto something there, Andy.
Well, we'll come back. As we've been mentioning Arsenal, we'll head back for a very quick look at the Premier League before we wrap up. One quick question before we do. From Busker Rhymes, who's asked, why don't clubs prioritise the Carling Cup more, especially clubs like City and Liverpool, who could use the silverware? Chris?
Well, they should, frankly. I'm a big fan of the League Cup, always have been, largely because I used to think that Villa's name was permanently on it. But I think it's a very underrated competition. There are legitimate reasons why a lot of these clubs don't pay the attention that it deserves. But really, there are clubs out there who could do with a trophy in the cabinet.
I mean, I saw this week after for Liverpool and Spurs fans, a lot of them were saying, "Oh, you know, we shouldn't. You know, let's just ignore the Carling Cup. Why do we even enter this competition? You know, Premier League teams shouldn't be in this competition. Let's leave it to the league teams." And I wanted to point out, and that's called the Johnson's Paint Trophy instead on there. But I mean, quick mention for Northampton, because that was a fantastic result for them last night. And it's the kind of thing that every lower league fan dreams of, going to see their team play at a place like Anfield, and then to win, absolute dreamland.
Win dramatic as well. It's just something that I probably will never experience, is my club going to a team divisions above and winning. And to do it at Anfield as well, with all the history that's gone on there, it's just a great night that they'll never forget.
Fantastic stuff. If we're talking about action-packed games, well, quick mention as well, because Tim, you were at Arsenal Spurs as well on the Carling Cup, which had its fair share of drama as well.
It did, yeah. I was mainly there for Sandro's first affair. It was his first time out in English football. It was fascinating talking to him afterwards, and he's a very interesting young man, I think, who will do well in English football. I think I agree with what you're saying about the Carling Cup. It's, you know, a chance to win a trophy. That's really not to be sneezed at, is it? You know, the silverware is so concentrated that you do wonder why some of the lesser Premiership sides, like Aston Villa, why they don't perhaps pay more attention to it.
Well, we went all out for it last season. At long last, Martin O'Neill it became a bit of a hallmark of his time at Villa that he wasn't paying attention to the cups that we were in, including in Europe. And last year, we sort of fluked our way through the Carling Cup. And eventually we started to look like we were in with a chance of winning it, got to the final and started taking it very seriously. And on that day, it would have been unbelievable to win it. It would have been fantastic. And I think Martin eventually came around to that way of thinking.
You're like, as Ian Holloway would put it, you're like a bad tea bag. You don't stay in the cup very long. He said that after one Plymouth game.
We just went to Wembley. after 10 years.
Let's move on to the Premier League. And Chris, probably in terms of the big ones in spectacle, Manchester United's 3-2 victory over Liverpool. I actually wasn't expecting this to be as good a game as it was.
Yeah, it wasn't bad, was it? I think it threatened to become slightly dull in patches, but it was lit up by one very special goal, and then Liverpool's comeback was incredible. And then pleasingly, although I don't say that very often about Manchester United, they got the winner.
They're probably deserved as well, you have to say.
Yeah, I think so. Liverpool were slightly fortunate to be back in it. The penalty was a penalty, but you're always lucky to get those. And a free kick as well. He found a gap in the wall. And it was 2-2 all of a sudden, and it really wasn't justice at that point. So for Berbatov to get his third was pretty much deserved, I'd say.
I mean, picking out a few other random results from the weekend. James... Everton didn't even starting with Jermaine Beckford up front against Newcastle. They started with Cahill and Fellaini up front on there, I think, on Saturday. And I mean, a lot of Beckford seems to be a strange move. Do you think he can cut it? Having, you know, Leeds fan, you'd seen him a fair bit last season. Missed a penalty as well midweek in the Carling Cup as Brentford put Everton out.
I had my doubts about Jermaine Beckford when he signed for Everton. When we originally talked about this in the summertime, I had to say that I didn't think David Moyes would be starting Jermaine Beckford anytime soon. I think that what I said at the time was that Beckford would be your man to stay fit for the entire season and to sit on the bench just in case, which is something that Everton have been lacking, as Anichebe, Vaughan, Sahar, Yakubu had like consistently come down with injuries and probably only played an average of 20 games a season between them. So Beckford, to me, has been thrust into the limelight too soon. At Leeds, he was brought up from Wealdstone. I think that was a jump of 5 divisions at the time, and started terribly. So he was sent out on loan to Scunthorpe. At Scunthorpe, I think he hit 10 goals in 20 games, so they brought him back, and that acclimatisation period did really well for him. And the rest is history as far as his Leeds career was concerned. That jump again has happened to take him into the Premier League, and as we all know, the jump from Wealdstone to Leeds, which is 5 divisions, it's probably not that dissimilar to a jump from a Championship club to a Premier League club in terms of the pace of the game, the physicality. the need to make quick decisions and good ones. And unfortunately for Beckford, he has been thrust into the limelight. And it hasn't even just been that he's missed chances. He hasn't even been there to take chances. And I think that David Moyes would be wise to heed the example of what happened to him at Leeds, where perhaps take him out of the spotlight, allow him to get used to the pace of the game, either by playing in the reserves and training every week with these top players, or possibly, you know, coming back on loan, maybe somewhere like Leeds. I wouldn't say no. But either way, going back to the Everton-Newcastle game, yeah, very disappointing result.
They don't start well, do they?
No, well, we say it every season, so it must be true. fantastic goal by Hatem Ben Arfa. I mean, who would have thought it?
Who knew anything about
Hatem Ben Arfa? Andy, please, for all those viewers who watch Match of the Day, please, can you explain a little bit about Hatem Ben Arfa?
Well, I guess the most intriguing thing about Hatem Ben Arfa, I mean, the goal is not really that much of a surprise. Everyone who knows him knows what an incredibly talented player he was. But everyone knows he's a bit of a head case as well. It's clear that he wouldn't be a player of that talent, would not be at Newcastle in their current situation if it were anything else. And really, there's so much potential for him to fall out with people in that squad. The biggest problem is all the people who he might fall out with in the squad are a bit harder and a bit bigger than him.
I'm going to drag things back to Beckford now. I'm going to take advantage of having both James and Andy in the studio. Jermaine Beckford, is he related to Carl Beckford?
Not that I'm aware of.
I was sat behind Carl on Tuesday at Tooting after he came off, and he was getting updates from the Everton game from someone in the crowd.
I'd never made
the connection before, and I can't find anything online to suggest that they are related.
It's funny, actually, because, of course, Carl Beckford used to play for Wimbledon, and when Jermaine Beckford was leaving Wealdstone, he actually had the choice between Wimbledon and Leeds. So perhaps he's just getting his comeuppance at the moment.
Who knows? I have to say that Beckford is just in a long line of footballing Beckford, starting with Darren, and who I think played for Norwich and maybe Everton back in the early 90s.
Did Port Vale?
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I think it's not too controversial to say that Jermaine is the best of the Beckfords.
We really have gone around. We've got plenty, loads just to whip through before we do wrap up. Tim, you mentioned Boselli at Wigan. They lost 2-0 to Manchester City at the weekend. But how do you think he'll fit in over here?
I wouldn't have bought him, to be honest. He's perhaps maybe a kind of Miroslav Klose type striker. He's not particularly big. He's not particularly quick. But he does have that knack of just coming alive in and around the penalty area. He doesn't offer you a great deal else. He doesn't do much else. He can't work the channels. He's not particularly quick. He doesn't hold the ball up. Doesn't combine particularly well. So in Argentina with Estudiantes, he was playing in front of probably the best midfield in South America, with Verón to pull the strings, Enzo Perez, who's an excellent player. Really good players there to make the bullets for him to fire. I just wonder with a club like Wigan whether he's going to get enough chances to do what he does best. And you can see already at the start of the season they were playing him, and then they were putting him on the bench, and now I think he's on the bench and not coming on. So already they seem to think, well, he's not quite there, and they've just brought in DeSanto, I think, who's getting a game ahead of him and offers more, because you can play up to DeSanto with his height. So Boselli is I love to be proved wrong in these circumstances when players end up doing better than you'd expected, but he's not a player that I would have bought.
Okay, very quick look ahead to the weekend's fixtures that are coming up in the Premier League. Chris, obviously the big one, Manchester City against Chelsea, the billionaire derby.
Yeah, and City have caused a few problems for Chelsea over the last couple of seasons as well. Should be a very entertaining game, could be one of those horrible turgid affairs as well. But I'm quite looking forward to giving it a bit of a watch and seeing if the two teams can shine as we know they should.
Who would you predict on that? Because obviously Chelsea have had an amazing start to the season, played some of the best football, I think, in the division so far. City sort of up and down a bit, as they usually are.
Yeah, for that reason, I think Chelsea will shade it.
Mm. I had a question from one of our listeners at Sporting Fair. Mancini to be gone by Christmas, surely. Anybody agree with him?
Absolutely not. I don't understand the inclusion of the word surely in that question. It's certainly by no means a foregone conclusion. And actually, although I was tipping Mancini to be gone before the start of the season, probably because of the inflated expectations of the owners rather than the potential for them to have a run of poor results per se. I actually think Mancini has proven, you know, not only to be able to get results, but to control a dressing room which may or may not necessarily be his, like, it may, the players that have been brought in may or may not be his choices. And I think he's done really well to bring a team together and mould them into an outfit that I think probably will finish in the top four this season.
We'll find out about their expectations before Christmas, because unless they have a really bad run of results, I don't think he will be going. And that will hopefully end whatever myths there are that result from the end of Mark Hughes' time there.
What I found quite unusual is the mega slating that he got in a lot of quarters for the sort of team he put out, West Bromwich Albion. Now, I understand we're giving it a bit of Carling Cup love, but he was saying, I think quite reasonably, it's all about the team I put out against Chelsea at the weekend. And he knows, well, whether he'll be finished by Christmas, I think he'll still be there after Christmas. I think the owners will be reasonable. But it's clear that if he doesn't make the top four, he's done. So that has to be the be-all and end-all for him. That's painfully unromantic, but that is the truth of it, especially for a club like City.
Mm. Various other fixtures as well. Liverpool Sunderland's one I'm quite interested in. It'd be interesting to see how Roy Hodgson bounces back from there. No beach balls this time around, let's hope, for Liverpool.
West Ham. I was just talking about Roy Hodgson the other day because I know this guy. I've got some mates from Croydon, and you know, I was asking them if they feel represented by Roy Hodgson, and the answer that I got was that yeah, they do, apart from one moment that apparently came up last season in Fulham's cup run when he kept on saying semi-finale. So you know that wasn't very Croydon at all. I think perhaps the only compensation we've got there is that whatever language he's speaking in, whatever his cultural baggage, he's always going to say Uwopa League.
I think he's probably very glad he got rid of Albert Vieira. Just briefly as well, seeing as we're touching on Liverpool, last question to round up to Tim. Do you think Hodgson will play Lucas a lot more, and do you think Lucas is a chance for him to come on? I mean, what you, Liverpool fans aren't massively enamoured with him. Where do you see Lucas?
Well, he starts off from a negative point in that Hodgson is clearly unhappy with the South Americans that have been brought in by the previous regime. He's offloaded a few of them. And with some of them, you just couldn't imagine why Liverpool were buying them. And I think Hodgson's point is correct, that Liverpool had an enormous squad full of players who were too old for the reserves and never really going to quite make it. I mean, I remember seeing Emiliano Insua for the first time. This is at under-20 level for Argentina back in 2007, the start of 2007. And within about 10 minutes, I thought, well, you know, this is quite a neat, well-organised player. But at the very highest level, I think he's too short for a centre-back and not quick enough for a left-back. And that's essentially been his Liverpool career, you know. So why these players were bought, I really don't know. And Lucas was, I think, a Benitez favourite. I think Lucas, there is huge potential there. You don't get voted the best player in the Brazilian league without it. Part of that was kind of a little bit of wishful thinking element, because he is an all-round midfielder of the type that Brazil haven't produced so many recently. So I think perhaps there was a desire for him to be good. Something I've heard which worries me a little bit is I did some radio with Howard Gale, you know, the former Liverpool player. And he was saying that Lucas has acquired a reputation for being excellent in training. And you get players like this, you know, who are wonderful in training and come the real thing, are a little bit timid. And that's clearly been an element in Lucas' displays with Liverpool. Perhaps not always easy for him to fit into a Steve Gerrard midfield. But without the protection of Rafa, This is delivery time, isn't it? This season will define one way or the other if he has a future at Liverpool or not.
Mm, okay, I was going to say wrap up there, but I'm just going to ask one more question to Chris. Where do you see bragging rights in Wolves Villa going?
I think we'll win.
That's confidence.
Pretty confident, yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
We'll see. No reason for it.
No.
Just a feeling.
Can you give that prediction in a broad Birmingham accent, please?
Unfortunately not. I would imagine you could probably do a better Birmingham accent than me.
Well, I could say, would anyone like a biscuit? That's as good as it gets from them.
I've just had a new flatmate move in, and he has the most Brummy accent ever. He's possibly... I think I'm going to be speaking Brummy by the next time.
Villa's going to beat the Wolves.
He's a good clown, though.
Is he?
Yeah.
How excellent. Yeah. Good.
There's a lot of you around.
I'm going to end up developing a Black Country accent living with Mrs. Chris as well.
Something to look forward to on the pod. Okay, we'll wrap it up there. Andy, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
James, thank you.
Likewise, a pleasure.
Tim, thank you.
My pleasure indeed.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, dear listener. We'll be back same time next week. Twofootedtackle.com